The Sacred Changemakers podcast is supported by Coaches Business School, helping the world's most caring coaches build a purpose-driven and profitable business that makes a meaningful impact in our world. Check out their unique frameworks and methods to help you transform and grow your business. Now is the time to build a bridge from what you want in life to include what the world needs. You can do well in business and do good. And together, we can make a meaningful difference. Find out more at coachesbusinessschool.com.
Hey there, and welcome back to today's episode of the Sacred Changemakers podcast. Our guest on the podcast today is Stephen Morris, an ever-curious life seeker, brand and culture-building expert, and author of The Beautiful Business. Now, Stephen's got over 25 years of entrepreneurial experience. He has served as a trusted advisor to over 3,000 business leaders and evolved more than 250 brands and cultures, including giants like Google, Habitat for Humanity, and Disney. His book, The Beautiful Business, and his widely read blog are a testament to his consulting expertise in creating unignorable, magnetic, and sustainable companies. His diverse interests, including meditation, fine art painting, surfing, and beekeeping, kind of infuse his work with a little more creativity, soul, and a deep understanding of the human experience. So I've been wondering what I can say about this conversation that would do it justice, because there are so many insights packed into our short time together, and we explore so many different themes that weave together the intersection of spirituality, innovation, and sustainability in the context of life, leadership, and business. Stephen makes the profound case that artistry and soul, they're not just personal pursuits. They're the bedrock of a genuinely vibrant workplace. And we address how these core values shape individuals and companies' decisions and trajectories. Through a rich and vibrant dialogue, Stephen shows us the path to redefining success to encapsulate well-being, environmental integrity, customer contentment, and also community impact. We talk through the realms of human artistry and its alignment with Stephen's concept of the beautiful business. And in doing so, we discover the transformative potential of leadership and culture that kind of organically emerge from this mindset. We'll learn about approaching business with a more reverent heart, embracing unseen forces and nurturing reciprocity in relationships, all while fostering a sense of connection, belonging, and resilience in the face of uncertainty. Stephen guides us through the three main doors of entry to organizational evolution, highlighting how these elements are needed for real sustainable transformation. So, this conversation was deep, and it captured Stephen's passion for his work, awakening businesses to cultivate and express a better or maybe even a more human future. But he also makes a compelling case for embracing human artistry and imagination to forge a beautiful business as a force for good in the world. I hope you'll join us for this engaging episode where we uncover the path toward wholeness in business and leadership. So I'm just telling you, prepare to be inspired, challenged, and moved as we take a sacred expedition into the essence of a beautiful business with today's guest, Stephen Morris. Hey, Stephen, welcome to the Sacred Changemakers podcast. How are you doing today?
Jane, I am doing excellent and phenomenal. I'm thrilled to be here. And thank you. Thank you for hosting.
No, I'm really looking forward to our conversation today. You know, we've known each other for probably a couple of years now through a mastermind group that we're in. But, you know, the more I get to know you, the more I realize the depth of your work, and which is why I'm so excited to share your genius today with the Sacred Changemakers audience. But before we do, you know, our audience have just heard your professional bio. And I'd love to take a moment and go beneath the surface of that with you to understand a little bit more about the real life human that lies underneath. Who is he?
Well, I love this question. And I honestly, I have a hard time answering it because there's a lot that makes up the human journey as you spend a lot of years growing, evolving on this wonderful, beautiful, sometimes difficult planet that we're on. Probably the simplest way for me to talk about this is the mindset that I have that I am a human artist. And I'll unfold that in a variety of fashions, but I'll try and keep it from a biographical perspective. So human artistry is a term that I've been thinking about a lot for the last several years. It's a term that's included within the beautiful business. And it's human artistry is a way of living in the world that is connected to your soul's purpose, connected to the activation of your imagination. And it's a way of living from an artistic perspective, which includes risk-taking and creating a sense of belonging, connection with nature, connection with other people. And so, you know, if I were to rewind the game tape of my life, you know, going back to my early childhood, I was always an artist. You know, my first, you know, even official academic training is in fine art, along with psychology. But, you know, from the youngest ages, I was producing artwork. I was, you know, less interested in, you know, TV and in social things. And I could often be found, you know, sitting on the floor or in my bedroom, sketching, drawing, painting, whatever. And, you know, the artistic path has been a great teacher for me. And by the artistic path, I don't mean just creating art and artifacts. I mean being open to noticing what the world has to offer and learning from the world as a teacher so that you can embrace the beautiful seen and unseen nuances of life. And so, you know, a human artist is one that lives not just in the world of reality, but also in the world of imagination and possibility, which is also weirdly, beautifully connected to the path of most entrepreneurs and business leaders. So I think the simplest way to describe myself as a human artist, and I've been utterly fascinated by this understanding of what a human artist actually is, practicing myself, apprenticing myself in and through that. And part of that has to do with developing a deep understanding of what motivates us as human beings. And that begins with a deep understanding of what motivates me. So when I think about, for instance, the idea of self-awareness as a very simple concept, it's actually not that simple at all. The way I think about it is there's two sides to self-awareness, one of which is the internal self-awareness, which really explores the question of to what extent do I understand who I am, who I really am, as both a human and a psychology and a spiritual being practicing on this earth. Do I understand the motivations that I have? Do I understand my core values? Do I understand to what extent do I understand my purpose in life and how I want to unfold that? So that's the internal self-awareness. And I think there's a ongoing contemplative practice to keep understanding that and to learn how to apply it. And then the other side of self-awareness is the external self-awareness, which is really answers the question, to what extent do I understand as I move through the world, how I affect the people around me? And so, you know, we could have, you know, skills in one or the other, but ideally we have both. And someone who is apprenticing themselves to that, and especially on the spiritual level. I've had multiple spiritual awakenings that have come from a variety of different directions. The more that I understand my soul's yearnings and what my soul wants to experience in this lifetime, the more I can help other people recognize, realize, and activate the same things. So, you know, I come from a very, you know, middle class family that, you know, I grew up in the inner city, and then we moved out to I would call the edge of the suburbs when I was in first grade. And it was literally the edge where it was like, you know, a farmer's field was on one side of the road and then, you know, had a forest on the other side of the road. And, you know, when you get old enough in America, you know, and you get your first bike, a bike equals freedom. And freedom is like, you get to go out and explore the world. And more often than not, I would be in the woods hiking and, you know, ride off on my bike to go through the cornfields and fishing and, you know, sitting in nature, sketching in nature. And so, you know, the artwork of my young life, the journey, and especially my connection with nature, these are things that are all incredibly important for me and have stayed with me from my earliest stages, even today. And as I look here, I sit on the edge of this beautiful place called Lopez Canyon in sunny San Diego, California. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's the quick backstory on, I think, who I am as a human.
I love the way you prefaced it at the end with, I think, so far, this is who I think I am. That's what I kind of got. But I really want to honor the richness of your response there, because I got a kind of a real sense of you when you know, kind of keeping the artistry alive in a world that's trying to create you into a scientific kind of mm-hmm. mindset. seems to me almost like an act of rebellion. And I don't know why, because it was a very quietly spoken way that you did it. But I really got this sense of you kind of moving in the opposite direction to the way that the world wanted you to be.
Yeah.
And I also sensed that when you said about the self and the level one of the self, which is who am I? But then you quickly said, who am I really? Because of course we all have answers that just trip off the tongue with who am I? But of course, there's a depth underneath. And who am I really takes us into that wellspring of kind of what is underneath there, and a curiosity and an exploration that not many of us choose to take, in my experience. So what is it within you that has kept this alive, and was it a challenging thing to do? Do you see it in that way, as like an opposite to what the world wanted you to become?
I think you're describing in a very beautiful way the plight of really all human beings. You know, so we're born into a world that partially by design and partially by nature and nurture, that we have to fit into the family systems that we're born into, whatever the structure that looks like, simply in order to survive. And in order to survive, you get indoctrinated into those family systems, whatever that looks like, and you take on the beliefs and behaviors and even values of that family system in order to fit in. Because we as human species, the moment we're exiled from whatever group or tribe that we quote unquote belong to, the minute we become vulnerable and the minute we become, we drift into the world of danger. So we have to protect ourselves. We all need love, nurturing, and care. We all need to have that sense of connection, especially in our young, early ages. But that doesn't necessarily mean that we need to stay within those systems. And, you know, society wants a lot of things from us. It programs us to behave in certain ways. And, you know, I think in the Australian world, you have this wonderful saying, it's called the tall poppy syndrome, right? So the tall poppy syndrome, you could probably explain this better than me, but as I understand it, it's don't be the tallest poppy in the field, because the minute you stand out, then all of a sudden you're calling too much attention to yourself. And the converse or negative effect of that is that they want you to fit in and they want you to be just like them. Where I think the more you live an examined life, be that a spiritually examined life, psychologically examined life, or just a life of active noticing, the more you understand that I may have a set of belief systems, I may have even a way of the way I want to move and live through the world that isn't necessarily aligned with my upbringing and the programmatic elements that indoctrinated all these beliefs. So I think you go through a process, one can go through a process of examining what's truly mine to keep, to have, to hold, and what is in the backpack of life that's weighing me down, that's time to take those rocks out, put them by the side of the trail, and then pick up things that actually truly belong to me. So maybe it's an act of rebellion, but I think it's also an act of claiming who we truly are if we're called by the deeper inner compass of our life's calling. And here I mean, if we were to ask ourselves the question, not do what do I want out of my life, which tends to drift into this set of considerations around accomplishment and success, but rather, what does my soul want to experience in this lifetime? There's two things that begin to happen within that. First and foremost, you're asking yourself a question from a very different part of yourself. And then there's the invitation for that part of yourself to answer, which is the soul response. Mm-hmm. And the soul cares nothing about accomplishment, success, recognition, or any of that. The soul, at least from my experience, it wants experiences that enliven us, that improve us, that open us, and that shed what I would consider beauty and goodness into the world. And so when the really question is really, who are we asking and why? And the more I live through life, the more I want to ask the questions of my future from that soul perspective and allow the quiet, whispery voices of the soul to be the thing that comes forward to answer those questions. And for me, then my only job is to have enough courage to listen to that and live that into whatever my life is.
I love your response there, because straight away, I mean, we get a sense of the texture, not just of you as an individual, but of your work here. Because what I'm really sensing into as you're speaking, Stephen, is you're going beneath the surface. It's like you're connecting on a soul level with yourself and therefore able to connect externally on a soul level with others as well. So this to me, I mean, when I look out in the world, and I particularly in the leadership and business space, it's almost like we've lost our soul somewhere along the way.
Yeah.
And it's like we've forgotten it. We've almost drilled it out of organizational life. So one of the things that is really coming up for me, and I guess it's an assumption I'm making, but you know, is that why you've chosen to work in that context? Because I can kind of see the foundations of a beautiful business lying in the beautiful life and existence, human life first.
Yeah. I think a lot about why did I choose to, and why do I continue to choose to work in the world of corporations and business? And I have sort of I have a pragmatic answer to that, and I have a more soulful answer to that. The pragmatic answer is that, and it's not hard to see, that we as society have lost faith in large institutions, governments, most religious organizations, certainly political organizations. And that doesn't mean we stop living, though. So what is it that we believe in? And I think a lot of people, especially in Western culture, because we live in a capitalist society and we spend so much time at work, people are beginning to ask themselves, well, okay, how can I find more meaning through the work that I do? And so I think there's the beautiful opportunity, a big opportunity for business leaders to really look at how do we create business environments, businesses, and business environments where people can actually exercise their own sense of freedom and their own value system and feel like they're contributing to something that's larger than themselves, which an examined life will ultimately lead you to. And so I think there's a lot of healing to be done in those environments. And that healing is an encouragement towards wholeness, both for the individuals, for the teams, and for the organizations, and potentially even society. So While that may not, the surface may not sound like a pragmatic answer, I think it actually is, because if business is here to continue, so like the game of business is not a game that you can win, right? So it's like there's no winner take all kind of thing, even though some companies might actually behave it that way. So then you think about the game of business, the rules of the game of the business is to keep playing. So then how do you keep playing? How do you stay in the game? You create an organization that is magnetic, attractive, has an aura about it that pulls people in, both customers and employees, so that it can continue to evolve, grow, and create value for people on all kinds of different ways. So, I mean, when you look at it that way, it's a very pragmatic answer for any business leader out there thinking about, well, how do I play the game of business? Stay in the game. How do I stay in the game of business? You keep creating something that's valuable. And the way to do that is through this, you know, read the beautiful business first, but it's through creation of something that is utterly valuable for the people internally that feel that they're contributing to something larger than themselves, and for the customers, be they a service or product company, that continues to add value to their lives. So that's the pragmatic side. From a much more soulful perspective, maybe I'll challenge your assumption a little bit, because I think you said earlier on that, you know, we've lost the soul of business. I'm not even sure it was ever there. so there's that to begin with, right?
Right.
And so all that aside, is that the more we awaken as human beings into what are we really here to do, the more that we can think about business from a soul-oriented perspective. And, you know, I'll even talk openly within some of the organizations that I work in, is what is the soul of this company? How would we describe, if let's just imagine, put all your preconceived notions aside, if this company had a soul, how would we describe it? Now, they may describe it from an energy standpoint. They may describe it from a feel standpoint. They may describe it from a purpose standpoint. All those are perfectly viable answers, but it's the souls that contribute to the success of that business, be they the employees who move that company forward and serve the customers, or be they the customers that actually buy from that business. So ultimately, as we know, business is all about, for and about people, and people have souls. There's no like debating that. I don't think there's a current debate about that. If there is, it would be a very short one, I think. So I do think that soul within business is a topic that should be discussed a little bit more. And that goes on sort of on the meta level within the business and the individual level for organizations. Strangely enough, a friend of mine and I just co-wrote an article, and the title of the article, it'll be published in Barron's, I think, next month. The title of the article is, "Does Spirituality Belong at Work?" And so when I wrote that headline, I was very intentional about it, because really what we're exploring within that article is the whole question or consideration around the DEI initiatives that haven't really been working. But if we're going to talk about inclusion, for instance, as part of the DEI mindset, then what are we including? Are we including, certainly most of the conversation or the safe side of the conversations right now, it seems like, well, it's race and it's gender and it's, you know, people's belief systems, et cetera, et cetera. So what if I have a spiritual belief from whatever faith that is? Does that belong at work? And my testament, and Denise Leung, who's my dear friend and co-author on this article, we would both agree that it absolutely belongs at work. And the reason it does, or one of the reasons it does, is that people's individual faith or spiritual belief systems define to a large extent what their core values are. Mm-hmm. So PricewaterhouseCoopers recently just came out with a study that said 80% of millennials want to work for an organization whose core values align with theirs, not the other way around. So if my own core values are being invited into the world of work, and I'm looking for a place to contribute my effort and my genius and my passion and my skill and my expertise, I'm going to look around at an array of options that says, who of those choices out there align most with my own core values? And if my core values come partially from the spiritual beliefs that I have or religious beliefs that I have, how do they not belong at work? So, and how could we possibly even pretend to segregate them and check them at the door when it's part of who we are?
You know, listening to you makes perfect sense, doesn't it? Like, of course they belong at work. Because one of the questions I've often asked over the years, you know, of leaders is, you know, or to different people is, how able are you to bring your whole self to work?
Yeah.
Right? How is that? And very often people are like, what? Like, because there's not even an expectation that all of them would be welcome. They're just coming in this robotic fashion that's performance driven, and anything that's measured gets done, and anything that's not measured kind of falls by the wayside. And we end up with people in the quiet resignation of, you know, I'm here, I do what I've got to do, and then I'm going home kind of thing. And so I love that you're speaking to this, but I'm also aware that, you know, probably quite a few of our audience haven't read your book, and I highly recommend it. So please go and pick up Stephen's book. The links are in the show notes. But what I want to say is, because I'm hearing it and I have a sense of it anyway, because of our previous conversations, but like, how does your approach through the beautiful business redefine success for organizations and leaders? Because I'm hearing a very different languaging, a very different conversation. And that little thing that you just slipped into the conversation, which is you can't actually win at business. When I know from my conversations with clients or potential clients, very often over the years, they would say, I just want to win. Like, how do we win? That's the strategy session today. Yeah. How do we win, right? So you're bringing in a different vernacular, a different language, a different value set. How would you describe how you redefine success?
Yeah, I think a lot of the success determination within the world of business, I mean, we could probably, you know, align on these very, very quickly, which tends to be an incredibly narrow set of metrics. Those metrics are almost always financial and almost always top line, bottom line driven.
Yeah.
And absolutely in business, non-negotiable. You have to make money in order to stay in business. You have to make profit in order to continue business.
Yep.
So got it. Check. Right. But is that why? It's not why. It's not why you do business. So then if you begin to ask the why question, you broaden the lens of, well, what are we here to do? And what does success actually look like from a wide variety of metrics? So in the beautiful business mindset, or even in the consulting work that I do, it begins with that conversation, which is aligning at some agreement system on the broad definitions of how success can be measured within the business. And what I'd like to do is challenge business leaders to think much more broadly about, well, what about the human side of success? How would we measure success from the people that contribute to the organization? If you want to keep employees engaged, happy, satisfied, not burned out, well, what are the metrics that support that? Then you go into a set of considerations around, well, what about our environmental practices and how we're accessing, utilizing, and applying our resources, be they time, money, energy resources, or environmental resources? Are there success metrics that we could look at that improve there? What about the world of our customers? What does success look like for them? How and in what ways are we improving the lives of them? And how are we holding ourselves accountable for what that success looks like in their world? A study I was reading recently is that the most effective marketing campaigns for organizations that are telling stories about what they do are what we call promise-driven marketing. And it's very, very simple formula, which asks the question of, is the company stating a valuable promise to a set of customers? And to what extent are they holding themselves through a measurement system to living up to those promises. Imagine a company that actually says, here's the promise that we state to you, and here's our track record of delivering on that promise. And now you have this consideration of, wow, okay, the first question is, do I believe them? And the second question is that promise valuable for me for whatever the product or service is? And if that's what the conversation is all about, then all of a sudden it changes the dialogue of I'm trying to sell you something versus I'm trying to help and serve you in some type of way. I'm just going to tell you a story about what that promise is and how that might help your world. So there's success metrics around that as well. Then you get into like families and communities and the kind of the echo effect, because no organization lives in its own bubble. It always is connected to a wide variety of things that live either connected to or outside of it. So typically it's a physical business that has a building. That building has a community. All the people within the organization have not just friends, but families in which they're providing for. How does that person who goes home at night, who spent 6, 8, or 10 hours a day or a 40-hour work week or whatever, how do they feel about their work? And how do their spouses and significant others feel about what they're contributing to? How do their children feel about how mom or dad is showing up at the end of the workday? Like, those are potential success metrics as well. And it goes on and on and on. But what I like to do is within organizations is to invite them to broaden the lens of what that set of success metrics is. And then they self-define the much broader sense of what that is, but still include money and profit within that conversation. Mm-hmm. And now becomes this very creative endeavor, right? All of a sudden, like we take the blinders off and say, okay, it's not just about money. Money's still on the table. But what else, and how are we impacting the world? And then it goes into, are we agreeing to play the game of business in the way I described it earlier, which is to stay in the game of business, which then has to do with a question around sustainability. To what extent, you know, if we write, for instance, a strategic plan for the next year or 5 years, how are we going to sustain ourselves through that? How are we going to adapt through that? What are our innovation policies look like? Those kinds of things.
That's lovely. It really is. And as you're speaking, I can hear the elements of human artistry that you described at the beginning starting to emerge into, you know, the workplace in a way. Because the whole time you were talking, I just got this sense that there's a simplicity in what you're talking about, and almost like a natural, organic, human approach to business, which, again, you know, is not something that's prevalent in organizational life. So what I'm interested in is, I'd just love to hear you speak specifically to how human artistry actually kind of sparks or catalyzes the evolution of leadership and culture within an organization. Because there's this cumulative effect that, of course, is guided by the leaders, but then ends up, I mean, I remember in my master's degree talking about tacit learning and intacit and all this stuff, but it feels to me there's a magic, there's a ripple effect and a magic that would kind of come out in the culture when people are, I'm going to say, held in this way.
Yeah.
Because it almost feels like, and I'm going to say sacred space, but that's what it feels like. And I'm not relating to any organized religion or even spirituality in a way, but it's like, isn't that what we're here to do as humans? Hold space for each other to be fully expressed.
Yeah, that's so well said. So a couple of mindsets around this. So the term reverence is something I tend to like to live into. And you know, reverence, very simply stated, is the assumption that in whatever situation you're entering into, even with yourself, that spirit already exists there. So all that is a recognition that there's something larger taking effect, right? It's not just the stuff that we see on the surface. So, and that includes in this conversation, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if we approach our work and our life with a sense of reverence, then we assume that spirit already exists there, and we work with, or we begin to work with what we call unseen forces.
Mm-hmm.
So what's unseen forces? Unseen forces are the things that include the imaginary realm.
Right.
And in the business world, the safe word for imagination or creativity is innovation. And that's nothing more than a process of, let's just envision what we can do next. And because it's an envision process, it is working with the unseen forces, right? Now, there is still a set of questions that have to do with, well, how are we going to do that? So going back into reverence, and I'll add another word into this, which I think you were hinting to, is this idea of reciprocity. And there's a sacredness in the reciprocity of not just the cycles of life, but the cycles of relationships. So it's my belief that we live in a world that has two really interesting things constantly at play. So we live in a relational world and we live in a dynamic world. So in the relational world, it says that we are constantly relating to the things, the places, and the people around us. And the more that we can be in coherence, and I mean this both energetically and from a somatics perspective, in coherence with those relationships, the more we can have this sense of connection, belonging, and even reverence. Again, the assumption that spirit exists in all of those things. So if we treat this beautiful, often challenging relational world with the sense of reverence, trusting that the spirit, if spirit exists, it exists in me and exists in you and exists in everything. So then you approach it from a very different, not just mindset, but heart set. And then we live in this dynamic world, right? So the dynamic world is really interesting because it includes chaos and change and all the things that are not within our control, which is much of our lives. So the more we acknowledge the reality of those two really fascinating worlds, the more that we can say, oh, well, if it's about relationship first, in especially in the world of business, then who am I and how am I showing up within that? And how am I contributing to all the relationships that I have, not just at work and elsewhere? And then how am I dealing with the dynamic elements that include the not just the unseen things, but also the things that are outside of my control, which then I have this sense of center within myself so that I can adapt to the things that are happening all around me.
Mm-hmm. You know, it reminds me of the work. I don't know if you're familiar. It's a guy from Europe, a guy called Arthur Mindell, who talks about different levels of reality. Because what I'm hearing you like describe here is it's almost like together with the leaders, they're creating or co-creating like a different level of reality inside of organizational life. You could say a different level of consciousness, I guess, because you know many of us describe things in levels of consciousness. But it's almost like with this reverence coming in, you know, in this relational and dynamic field, it's almost like you're taking an organization that's very grounded in the transactional and the physical. And we could say transforming, but in my map of the world, I'd actually say transcending
into this.
So it's almost like we're not, it's not that this transactional level is wrong. It's very valuable. It's needed, right? You know, profit is needed to make the business. But what you're also doing is expanding that reality, Stephen, into a more reverent space, a higher level of consciousness, so that they can work within the full spectrum of that, which creates more meaning, more fulfillment for the human. And in Arthur Mandel's world, he talks about essence, and then he talks about dreaming, and then he talks about collective reality. And I can see that mapping against our conversation today, because of course, everything begins with essence. It then moves into the dreaming space where we start to strategize, create the promises for the organization, you know, the leadership strategies, all those things. And then it moves out into the collective reality, how we embody and live in alignment with everything here that we've decided. And I love this because there's no doubt business is a big problem in the world today. It's unsustainable, the way that we're living and doing business. And I think that somehow it's been very easy for business leaders to kind of ignore that, given the pressures that they're under for stakeholders and delivering on profit and growth on growth every year. But it's almost like we need to step back and look at the systems of business that we have today, because I'm hearing you in a very gentle way, kind of redefining, not just the way the individuals feel, but the systems of business, which is always the challenge because of the complexity and everything there. So, you know, when we think about different ways of working in organizations, of course, we can work at different levels of system. Like, where does your work fit? Because I kind of see it fitting through all of them.
So the work that I do, imagine, if you will, a room that has three doors to it. And I'm going to go into a little bit of the story within this. So imagine a room that has three doors to it. And in my consulting work, door number one, and this is not in any particular order, but door number one is what we call the brand door. So in the brand door, you know, typically a company or business leader will come to me and they'll raise their hand and say, well, we've got a branding problem. And usually the way they'll articulate that is through one of a few different ways, which means our customer trust is going down. We're entering a new market. We want to change the perception of how we're seen by the outside world. So that's the brand door. The second door that I work within is the culture door. And the culture door is, you know, when someone comes to me, they raise their hand and they say, well, we've got a people problem. And it typically falls in the things that we would all be aware of, which is employee retention, engagement, alignment on teams. Maybe, you know, we have silos within our organization and we need to remedy that. There's all kinds of stuff that happens within that particular realm. So that's the culture door. And then the third door is what I call the business strategy door. And that could also be the vision door. So the business strategy door says, well, we're really reinventing, or we're wanting to re-envision where we're going as an organization. And we could use somebody's help in articulating that, helping us come to ground with what that is, bring meaning to that. Now, what they don't realize, at least at first, unless they've read a lot of my stuff, is they all enter into the same room, right? So there is an integrated process between the strategy has to be delivered by a set of somebodies, right? So who is that set of somebodies? That's the people within the organization. And all of a sudden, it's a cultural question or cultural integration. So when we think about a crafting of a business strategy, it's one thing to craft a business strategy or some vision for the organization, but then you have to bring the team along to ensure that the conditions are created so that strategy actually takes root. So then we go from the strategic work into typically a storytelling process so that the team understands their role in it. And then they roll that out over a period of time, whatever that time is. And there's junctures and there's other details within that. And then we say, as this strategy begins to take root within the organization, we've got to tell the world in some way, shape, or form. So the brand's got to be involved in that. So, and it can work. It doesn't have to work in that particular fashion, like strategy first, culture second, brand third. It can work from we've got a brand problem and we're going to involve the culture within that, because the culture, if the brand creates a promise to the outside world, it's the culture that delivers on that promise. It's the culture that lives up to that promise. And then it's got to connect with the business strategy in some way, shape, or form in order for the business to see its way forward.
Right. Love it. It just makes perfect sense the way you describe it. You make it sound so simple and so easy to do. So kind of that's my devil's advocate question. Like when you go into an organization and you start this work, I know there's a, I've had in my career, and I'm sure you have too, people going, oh no, we don't want to go there. Like we don't want to open that can of worms, right? Let's just put that over there. So
Sure.
how, I'm going to say, how easy is it to do this work? And why is it something that business leaders should be considering?
Well, it's often not easy if there's resistance. And I sit in a very blessed position in the way that I put myself out in the world. And it's a big enough way that the people that come to me have some understanding of what I do and how I do it and why I do it. So that doesn't mean there's no resistance at all.
Right.
So a lot of the questions have to do with, well, okay, now that we've done the brand work or the strategy work, how do we work the culture into this? Because that's, you know, it's very complex and depending on the size of the team. And I'll work with teams like Google is one of my clients, you know, 180,000 people. And now I'm not working with 180,000 people. I'm working with the leaders of different divisions. Or even a company, let's take a less complex scenario where they have, you know, 1,000 people, 1,500 people, 1,800 people. How do we evangelize this out and through the team? And so the process typically is, well, do we understand the big picture of what we're trying to do here? And are we committed to the long tail, the long version of that? Because as you can imagine, even describing some of these processes, let's say it's even strategic planning into culture, into brand.
Yeah.
That's potentially a 6 month to 2 year process, depending on the complexity of the organization. So then there has to be some level of conversation around what is our level of commitment to actually see this through? Because if we only do the upfront work, whatever that upfront work is, and we don't integrate it, create wholeness within the organization, not just for the individuals, but for the team, then the likelihood of this strategy or this whatever initiative is growing root over a period of time is not going to happen. So there is conversations that have to happen around sense of commitment and even the dedication of time, energy, and resources in order for that to happen. So these are like, okay, so we're committed. Great. All right, let's look at the kind of resources that we're actually going to commit to this. What is the time frame that we have patience for in order to see certain junctures ahead? And what are the human capacity issues? So I've got this framework around capacity, appetite, and skill set that enables us to measure in certain ways the individual and or team effectiveness, but it works for the organization. So just very quickly, capacity says, do we have the resources required to do the thing at hand? And that could be time, energy, money, resources. Then we have a skill set question, which is, what are the skills that we need to have and or develop on our team or import from other sources on our team in order to execute on the plan that we're putting forward? And some of those skills may be human development skills or self-awareness skills. Some of them may be training around, you know, help desk and, you know, technical training and things of that nature. And so appetite is what is our hunger? What is our appetite? What is our thirst for seeing this through? How driven are we to make this happen? And that has to do with an upfront articulation of what is it that we're doing here and what is the work at hand, which is a why-oriented question. So back to your question, a lot of the quote-unquote convincing is not convincing at all. It's for them to understand what's at stake short-term and long-term for the organization, and do we believe that we as an organization can actually achieve that, and to what extent are we committed to it? And then I just, you know, play Sherpa, guide, cajoler, and supporter, adventurer, and human artist to help them through that journey.
Yeah. And I just want to underline for our listeners here, the artistry in what you're describing, because very often a conversation that's alive in our communities is this idea of trying to like push or convince or have a conversation with a leader about the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals and why they need to change things. And it's obviously not working. And what I'm hearing from you is you're weaving in this artistry into the way that you're listening to what matters most to the organization, right? And that's the starting point. What matters most?
Yeah.
And then it's almost like you take them on this elegant journey, just continuously, right? Step by step, expanding their awareness to the next door and then the next door until, of course, you've got the whole picture in front of it. And then it's their decision. Because, of course, at that point, it's obvious that the cost implications of not doing this work is far greater than doing this work, right? I can see that. And yet, you know, and I think this is so valuable for our listeners to hear, especially those that are consultants or leaders inside of organizations. It's like, stop the push. Mm-hmm. It's that idea of reciprocity that you talked about before, is there's ways to do this in ways that matter to the organization as it is today and gives them and guides them into a better future. That's what I'm hearing. Does that make sense, Steve?
It does, yeah. And it's better defined by them. So it's not my better. It's not my version of better. I love creating space for them to define what their better, brighter, more beautiful, more effective, more impactful future could look like. And because the beauty of the world of business, or one of them anyhow, is that every organization, every business leader gets to choose on their own what that actually is. What does better mean? What does impact mean? What does this, what is this business all about? And I have frameworks of helping to cultivate these unexpressed things and bring language so that help them bring language so that not only can they understand it and it's distilled to this very potent set of languages, but it also can be evangelized and told through outside of the C-suite or the boardroom or whatever, so that the entire organization can understand what caused their joining in order for them to unite behind the creation of this future that they're all looking to create. So the single guiding mantra within my work, and it's in the beautiful business as well, is that there is nothing more powerful than a united group of souls ignited in a common cause with love at the core. So look through history, look through time, look through the world of business, understand the potency of that and break it down. So united group of people, how do we bond people around a something that is a cause? How do we move that forward? And how do we put love at the core of all of that so that everything that we're doing is an operation in service to love of the people, of the purpose, of the planet, of the families, of the business, of its profit. And it's a passionate and sometimes, and I mean this in the subtlest way possible, not in the sexual way, but it's an erotic form of love because that is an act of creation.
Yeah, it's definitely got eros in it. I can hear it.
Oh, yeah.
And so what would you say if I said to you, you're not a business consultant, you're in the business of human awakening.
I'd say keep that between us. No, but you know, it's funny. More and more and more, I'm actually becoming more comfortable with that. So if I'm in the awakening business, I'm helping businesses realize their own potential. I'm helping the individuals within those teams create wholeness within their lives. And if that's awakening, I'll take that all day long.
And it just came to me because, you know, very many spiritual traditions talk about show up and then grow up so that you can then rise up. So, you know, that elevation of human consciousness seems to be very alive in your work here. Mm-hmm. And I love the way that you express it. But I've got to ask you, like, what is your work in service of? What's the vision of the world that you're hoping to create, the impact maybe?
Yeah, well, I think you just hit on it. If my secret subversive wish is that more and more people awaken to their highest potential and recognize the inherent soul within them and live life through that, which is my definition of wholeness. Mm-hmm. And when we have wholeness in our lives, then we can bring our very best self to anything that we're doing. And that certainly includes the world of work. So it's helping people understand that this profound exploration of their own and claiming of their own human artistry, which includes the soul's perspective, and also the ongoing act of creation, noticing, risk-taking, and which includes everything on the junctures of the path of becoming your whole self. I want to help people do that.
Now, I know a conversation that's very alive for a lot of us at the moment, not just leaders, and you know, is this idea of like, where are we headed? So I'd love you to just give us a sense of your vision of the future. And see, because I feel it's very aligned to your vision of a beautiful business and human artistry. But I'd love to hear from you, like, where do you think we're going?
Well, I think we're going, and this is not crystal ball.
No.
This is my hope. I hope that we're going and heading towards a process of healing, because I think in order to claim wholeness in our lives, in our work, and in our businesses, we have to heal. And sometimes that means to let go of the old paradigms. It's almost where we began the conversation. Mm-hmm. Let go of the old paradigms that confine our ways of thinking, ways of seeing the world, ways of seeing our life, ways of seeing our business, and embracing our own created version of that, which would include an awakening process to our own largest potential in the world of work, in our lives, in both this dynamic and relational world that we talked about earlier. But it does begin with a healing process. And I think there's a lot of trauma in this world. I think there's a lot of people who have been traumatized either in the world of work or elsewhere, who end up hurting other people. And until and unless they heal themselves on a very deep level, then we're not going to be able to realize our wholest potential. But I see a lot of that happening. I see a lot of healing taking place. I see a lot of support and compassion, including self-compassion, taking place. And I think we're on a journey, on a path that's paved with healing and self-compassion. And I hope we continue to walk it.
Mm. So I hope you don't mind, but kind of a coaching question's coming up for me.
Sure, sure. Yeah.
Which is, and it's kind of a personal question as well, which is that given the work that you do about helping people kind of awaken to the next level of their life or work or leadership or whatever it is, I just wonder, like, what is there in your own life and work that remains unexpressed, that might be just hinting at you at some point right now, but is not yet fully expressed, that might be the next step in the evolution of your life and leadership?
Yeah. This mindset of human artistry, while I talk about it in certain circles, there's so much richness to that. It's a way of living. It's a way of being and connecting with the world that I don't think is fully expressed at this point. Mm-hmm. And I think tangential to that, there's a sibling element to that that I haven't quite fully come to recognize or fully understand. But my intuition and my instincts are telling me that the healing process that we all need to go through as humans is something that I think we need to take very seriously. And it's something I've taken very seriously for myself. So like one of the trainings that I'm just getting into, and it comes from work that I've done on myself with a counselor, is around the work of Peter Levine and his somatic experiencing. And so I'm now getting trained in that. My wife is getting trained in this. And it is a profound framework and approach for healing the trauma that lives in the body and helping other people heal their own trauma. So just very quickly, I come from a background that has abuse in it from a very young childhood age. I've done a lot of work around that. And this somatic experiencing work has been by far the most effective work to heal that particular trauma. And there's a spiritual attribute to that as well. I consider it sacred work. And so I think to your question, this sacred healing process is not yet been fully expressed, developed, and or talked about, or even, you know, I'm still in the middle of it. So, you know, how like when you're in the middle of something, it's like the eyes of the horizon, the eyes that can see the horizon are not fully formed.
And there's such a synchronicity to what you're saying there, because you probably don't know this. Some of our audience will. I had a terminal diagnosis back in 2004, and it wasn't through an infection. It was through a medical injury. But Peter Levine's work was the guidance that got me back to life. And recently, last year, I had a spiritual moment, I guess, where I was back with a tiger, and it took me right back to his book, Waking the Tiger. So it's recently become back alive for me again. I learned so much through his processes that actually is incredibly applicable in organizational and leadership life.
Absolutely.
And so, yeah, and I would love to see you integrate some of that in a bigger way in your work, because I feel that there's a lot we can learn from the somatics and the healing journey.
I'm early on in that training, but it is, I think, maybe 3 years out, there's going to be a lot more, I believe, a lot more somatic experiencing types of training in the world of work that can heal lots of things, lots of people, lots of organizations.
Yeah, I agree. Stephen, this conversation has been amazing. So I just want to kind of conclude with a final question, which is, if there's something that you wanted to cover today, maybe we've not had time to get there, or it might just be leaving our audience with some words of wisdom, what might it be?
Yeah, the ground that we've covered, I feel complete with that. And there's, you know, some corners that we can certainly go into. I think the words of wisdom is, you know, as people begin to understand, and maybe they've listened to this conversation and gotten a sense of what human artistry is all about, the words of wisdom that I would have, or the encouragement that I would have, and maybe even the challenge/invitation that I would ask people, is to claim their own human artistry, because it is a birthright. Our birthright to have this application and exercising of our own imagination, our connection with our soul's yearnings, and to see the world as a canvas of possibility for the goodness that we can create, not just for our own lives, but for the people that we work with, live with, connect with, own and claim and live that human artistry.
Oh, I can just feel my heart opening as you're saying that. Yes. What a world we would live in if that was true.
Yeah, agreed. Wow. Agreed.
Wow. Stephen, thank you so much for stopping by the podcast today. I have totally enjoyed our conversation, and I know that our listeners will have gained so many insights from you. So thank you so much, my friend.
Absolutely, my pleasure. Thank you, Jane.
Okay, guys, that's all we have time for today. Thank you so much for listening in. Now, before we go, I want to remind you that all of the resources and the links for our guests are in the show notes at sacredchangemakers.com. A big thank you to the members of the Sacred Changemakers Inner Circle, who are our podcast sponsors, and also our extended community, who are helping us to make a global impact aligned with the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals, all visible on our website. And if you're looking for more soul in your life and business, if you have a sense that maybe you too have a calling, maybe you're here to make a bigger impact or simply connect with others on your change-making journey, if our episode resonated with you today, I hope you'll consider joining us. Again, you can find out more at sacredchangemakers.com. But for now, I just want to say thank you. Thank you for listening. Thank you for your intention and efforts to make our world a better place. Until next time, lots of love.